you're listening to CITR 101.9, and that was the tail end of Give 'Em the Boot. And you are now listening to Besneric Rhyme, and this is actually our last show, which is kind of sad. But hopefully we will move to greener pastures somewhere. So for this last show, I'm going to be playing an interview that I did with Stephen Price. For those of you who have heard the show before, you know that usually what we do is we take one poem by a local poet, and then we do the thing in the poem, and we talk about the poem. In this instance, we weren't able to do an activity, but I can give you some background on Stephen Price, which is that his book is called Anatomy of Keys, and it's a book about Houdini. And his family runs, I think this is like the oldest lock and key store in Victoria, so he has a bit of a family connection to this whole idea of binding an escape, if you will. So he came out here and we talked about one of his poems, and I'm gonna play the interview. All right.
18.2. That riveted iron boiler clanked and gurgled dully there, while hoses gushed and sluiced the tank until it held no air. A bucket clanged. Houdini rose, brandishing an axe. It was not true he would come to rue that night in Halifax. Three stage lamps smoked and guttered lean. Two fang-like lid bolts grinned. He struck and banged the boiler's seams for leakage near the hinge. The rivets whitened knuckle-like as liquid sucked them shut. But it was not he they'd come to see. That crowd had come for blood. Houdini lunked and scaled the tank, muscular and grim. He gripped its rim by knee and shank, then let the crowd grip him. A man can only hold his breath so long, he shouted down. But it is not right you've come tonight, half hoping I might drown, yet risking nothing more your own than nickels or a laugh. Hold your breath while I am down. See how long you last. Casket-like that boiler loomed, its rippling waters black, but it was no grave he'd come to brave that night in Halifax. Houdini's stagehands loosed a line and took the axe from him. He slithered in and floated blind as though within a womb and watched the widened eye of light above him, eyelid shut. It was not air he latched out there. He latched out all he was. That eerie belly held him warm. It shivered at each sound. His blood beat like a bat up barn, frantic, bashing round. A spangled stage light filtered in and lit his gray skin weak. But he felt no fright as the lock shut tight. That lid was forged to leak. At 30 seconds, ladies gagged. At 55, most men. 1:20, an athlete sagged. The clock went round again. Three swimmers choked, two divers next, but still that boiler sat. At last one said, he must be dead, a man all thumbs and hat. 3:10, 4:28, no man can live so long. A stagehand stood, hefting his blade, the audience a throng of throats and groans and fist-clenched thighs. Death had seized them here. For it's not in ease, most men believe. True art is found in fear. The axe blade glittered, menacing a bright, ferocious grin. Suspended in its heft and swing, it dragged the crowd's rage in. Yet there it hung, it hefted, hung poised and trembled deep. It was just this they'd feared to miss, when out he stepped, free. The curtain shook. Fine plaster fell. The audience had made it. Yet in that rush all somehow felt flushed, exhilarated, and unaccountably depressed. On stage the clock still stood. For it was not he they'd come to see. That crowd had come for blood.
Let's start with a minor thing. I wondered whether the word lunked was invented or whether it has roots somewhere
I think that's invented.
Okay. I noticed throughout the book there are a lot of words that I picked on thanked when I reviewed it as being an invented word, and I'd seen it elsewhere sort of, I'd seen other reviewers say, oh, he uses a lot of, you know, Anglo-Saxon words like thanked, and I'd sort of said, oh, I couldn't find, you know, a source for thanked.
There are quite a few invented ones. What I had in mind, what I was thinking about was, I was writing, you know, you'll work through a poem, and then I would reach a point where I didn't seem to be able to find the word that I wanted, you know, which is a common thing. And it's not that there wasn't a word that existed, there's just whatever word existed, often it didn't seem to be doing through sound what I wanted it to be doing. Although, you know, you could find some approximation of what you wanted to say. I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about how our language came together with Anglo-Saxon Latinate words and the origins, and I was thinking about how the Anglo-Saxon words in English tend to be very visceral, onomatopoeic kind of language words. And at the same time, I was thinking about what was going on with the Elizabethans, where Shakespeare, you know, Tim Bowling has a wonderful opening line of a poem where he says, no man was lonely before Shakespeare. And he's referring to the fact that Shakespeare coined the phrase lonely. And, you know, I was thinking about the way that language used to be fluid and a little bit elastic. I was longing for that, and I'd come up against this point where I couldn't seem to move forward. And I thought, you know, what the heck? And I was also thinking, of course, of, you know, when you're a child and you're reading a book and you come across a word that you don't understand, it doesn't make you stop and throw the book across the room and give up, because it's usually embedded in a context and you end up walking away with a new word, you know, a new understanding. So I was thinking about the way that you could throw in words that people didn't understand that could, through their context and through some kind of onomatopoeic weight, that they could mean exactly what you wanted them to mean, you know, and that English, although it's a rich language, it's got vaster vocabulary than any other language out there, you know, it's still, there are lots of words that we don't have. And so I thought, what the hell, I'll give it a try.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to me, lunked, when I look at the word lunked in that line, which is Houdini lunked and scaled the tank, muscular and grim, it has an echo of lungs, so you're sort of picturing, I feel like Houdini's lungs are really important in this poem, right? They're kind of what makes the whole event happen. And so you kind of picture him as this almost see-through person, and you can picture the lungs inside him really, really clearly as he's doing this specific action. And it has that also echo of clank, right, where it's this noisy. It made me actually think back to sort of wash tubs and kind of, you know, being bathed as a child, right? What other place? And it's not an invented word, and I'm not even sure I would call it an invented phrase, but I'm thinking of latched out over in stanza 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's just been locked in the tank, and this is them shutting the lid, and it says, it was not air, he latched out there, he latched out all he was. And for me, the two uses of latched out were actually different. Like, it seemed to me that the meaning of that phrase had changed in the space of that two lines. In the first line, it seems, with the, you know, sort of latch and key, it sounds like this is about excluding something. Like, air is the thing that has not been allowed into the enclosure, right? But then in the second line, it has a lot more connotative echoes, because it chimes with lash out, right, with that sense of anger. And sort of, it also sounds like a streamer striking out for shore with the out somehow. And I guess because it ends in all he was, you have a little moment where you're kind of going, well, is he what he is, inside or outside of the tank, right? Like, is this that he's excluding everything? Everything that he is what's left outside with the crowd, this impression of him. Or is everything, is this all that he is, this alone thing inside the tank?
I think part of what I had in mind with the all he was is certainly that his public persona remains outside. And the only thing that's left is a purely naked human being pursuing this personal struggle. And if he fails, he'll never get that public persona back. He has to escape every time, or, you know, a single failure means complete death. He vanishes as a public figure. So for him, everything that he has, everything that he's acquired and carried with him to this point in his life where he's an accomplished figure, all of that means nothing. When the lid closes down, all that's left outside, and there's, again, it's just him doing this pure struggle again. Thank you.
particular poem, like many in Stephen Price's collection, has a complete narrative to it. In this narrative, Houdini gets in a tank, the crowd expects one thing, and they get that thing. But according to the speaker, they feel disappointed because secretly they were hoping for something else. It's a poem with a lot of suspense, and I asked Stephen Price to talk about creating suspense in a poem.
The poem came from, I was struggling to write something in ballad meter.
Yeah,
that's what I was struggling to do. And I wanted to write something that fit a certain kind of ballad meter where I'd get the internal rhyme in the penultimate line. So that was really important to me. And I did have a strong idea that the best way to handle it is, of course, through a narrative poem, a narrative thing. And for me, one of the harder questions early on in writing this poem was the question of point of view, narrative closeness. And once I solved that, and that was sort of solved within the first stanza, writing the first stanza. Once I solved that, that's as soon as I could walk up to those final two lines of the first stanza, it was not true he would come to ruin that night in Halifax, then everything was pretty much established and clarified. So once that was established at the end of the first stanza, then everything else sort of started to fall into place. And the real questions that, of course, you have as a poet, as you know, aren't questions of how to manipulate the suspense. I mean, that tends to fall into place. It tends to be a sort of minute craftsman-like working out and reworking out of things. And you'll edit down things like, there's a line in here, in whatever, the sixth stanza, his blood beat like a bat up barn. And I worked and reworked and reworked that stupid line until I got enough plosives in there that it really felt like your mouth had to pop to get the movement through it. So, I mean, that's the sort of thing that I would really, really work at. It's really important to me in my poetry that the form is doing a certain amount of work, that the form never falls slack. So questions where suspense is raised or lowered, that has more to do with what I'm looking at on a minute level. And then if it works, and I don't know that it does, but if it does work, it'll be working sort of regardless of what I'm focusing on. Now, the Halifax thing is a reference that I threw in there that's bending facts. He didn't perform in Halifax in that way. I wanted to make this Canadian, a very deep Canadian.
That's interesting. Okay. What for?
Why did I want to do that?
Yeah.
Well, I was writing a lot of this book when I was down in the States as a graduate student, and I was feeling very isolated and alienated, and although it sounds a little bit odd, I was feeling very much like I was in exile.
Yeah.
You'll never find a more patriotic group of Canadians than ones who are living abroad someplace.
Sure.
You know? And everyone who lives here, of course, we speak very critically of our country. But, you know, so I was very homesick. And I also felt a certain, this is going off in a digression here for a moment, but I felt a certain desire to make sure that this book wasn't simply a biography of Houdini.
Okay.
So it certainly, by the time I wrote this poem, in the progression of the book, I knew that what I was exploring was a kind of psychological landscape or a mythology for myself and my family. So I knew that I wanted some kind of very deliberate imprint in the book that was more than the story of Houdini. So things like sticking in Halifax here, I didn't think it was a big break because, of course, he performed his tricks all over, everywhere, including in Canada. But so far as I know, there was no escape in Halifax in May 1907.
Like Robert Service's The Cremation of Sam McGee, Price's poem plays off the idea that audiences, be they readers, listeners, or a crowd at a spectacle, they like to be scared a little bit. There's a line in Price's poem that goes, "For it's not in ease most men believe. True art is found in fear." Here's Stephen Price talking about what that means for Houdini and what that means for the poet.
Well, I mean, he would... The reason why we still think of Houdini as the great magician that he was is that he was a master showman, and he knew how to manipulate a crowd. He knew how to play a crowd, play to its weaknesses and play to its strengths. So what he would do, I mean, with escapes such as this one, he would be enclosed in his cabinet, so they couldn't see him, but they knew that he hadn't escaped because they had checked for trapdoors and et cetera, et cetera. He would sit there. He would be out of the thing within moments. And then he would just sit there, and he would usually read a newspaper backstage. And he got so careless late in his career, you know, because it was so easy and so boring for him, that sometimes the orchestra would have to play twice as loud because they could hear him turning the pages of this newspaper. But he would stay back there, and he would wait, and he would wait, and then after 4 minutes or so, when, you know, everybody was convinced that he had drowned, and the drama had built to this ridiculous climax, and this assistant would come out with this, the axe ready to break open the cabinet to free him, then he would douse himself in water and step out as if he had just escaped. And the reason he did it, of course, is that he realized that if it looked too easy, nobody was impressed. And in fact, the hardest escapes that he ever did were not dramatic. I mean, they were incredibly skilled extrications from certain incredibly difficult handcuffs. And nobody cared. The first time that he escaped from straitjackets on stage, he would do it in his little cabinet. And he would be bruised and battered and beaten bloody, and he would step out after escaping from this thing, and nobody would applaud. You know, they would think, oh, he just got somebody back there to help untie him. And then, one time, the cabinet wasn't available. And so he said, what the hell, I'll just escape from the straitjacket anyways in front of them. And the audience was riveted. They were gripped, and they watched him thrash about on the floor, free himself, and it was a standing ovation. It was his first real breakthrough. It was a brilliant, brilliant thing. And he realized that they like to see the struggle. They like to have a connection there. They want to feel that this is a small man facing unbearable odds who somehow pulls through. And that was his connection with the audience. What is the line saying about art itself as a larger metaphor? Fundamentally, on the surface, my concern was with explaining how Eric understood you were supposed to run a crowd. But of course, there's also a certain amount of play in there, in the sense that I'm writing this as a ballad. I'm writing it in a ballad meter, which is a very old traditional form, and it's one that sort of bounces along. And once you have some small grasp on metrics, I mean, it's relatively easy to write. And so there's a certain amount of discomfort there that I have, and that I'm trying to write what is to me a serious project in a form that tends to bring it down to a more folksy sort of level.
Sure.
Do you know?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like The Cremation of Sam McGee, right?
Which was written in the same measure, yeah.
One thing that I thought about the book as a whole was that there is this heavy presence of kind of Anglo-Saxon language, right? And I kind of wondered how fit you felt the tone was to the actual subject matter. I wondered about the historical context of Houdini. You know, he's sort of this 20th century, early 20th century, but 20th century American at the end of the day, you know, came to Canada, came to the States as a kid. And then there's the poetic voice, which seemed much more sort of archaic and uses much fancier archaic language and uses sort of all these British-influenced kind of verbal tricks. And I guess I wondered how you felt like those two came together.
That was very, very early on in the book. And the book took 7 years to write. And very, very early on in writing these poems, I came face-to-face with that problem. Do I write these poems in ostensibly Houdini's voice, or my approximation of Houdini's voice,
right,
or do I not? And part of the problem with writing them in Houdini's voice is that he was a particularly inarticulate man.
Okay.
I mean, he was a very, very intelligent man, exceptionally intelligent, but he had no formal schooling at all. He couldn't write. I mean, he was literate, but, you know, rife with spelling errors and grammatical mistakes, and he would leave all of these sort of hyper-sentimental notes for his wife Bess lying around, like 12, 16 notes a day, and they would be things like, "My dear Mopsy, Fopsy, Frumpy Mumpy, how sweetie you are, love your Harry." And, I mean, when you're writing poetry,
personally,
sure, that's...
I think that's awesome. I would fully have included that.
at a certain point early in the book, I was playing with this idea of working in his voice. But then I realized, first of all, that it was extremely limiting. Second of all, I didn't want to do what Ondaatje did with Billy the Kid. I didn't want it to be that sort of a book. And
just for our readers who aren't maybe familiar with that, like, what about that kind of fit? What didn't work for you?
Well, that seems to be more of a collection of clippings and a sort of scrapbook collage type book. And it's brilliant for what it is, absolutely brilliant. And of course, it had a huge influence on me wanting to, you know, write a sequence of poems about a historical figure. But it's not me. And I also realized that I couldn't catch Houdini's voice. Hmm. It would just be my version of Houdini's voice. And this biography that I was going to write was going to be, and this was all reasonably early on in the project, this was going to be my version of Houdini's biography. And in fact, all of the biographies that I read, and I read pretty much everyone that's out there, there's 15 of them or so, they were all versions of his life too. And, you know, if you got someone like Ruth Brandon, who seems to very much dislike her subject, you got a certain Houdini who's, the facts aren't wrong, but the interpretation of the facts are very slanted. or if you got Kenneth Silverman's biography, which is, in which he seems to really admire Houdini, his interpretation of the same facts carries a very different resonance. So, you know, I understood that this was going to be my version of Houdini. And I also understood that in order for me to write this book, that I had to have, there had to be a spark there, something passionate. I had to be in the book. It had to be about me, fundamentally. Which, you know, also was to a large extent the impetus for me to extend this out into a longer sequence of poems instead of the 10 or so that I originally imagined, which was that this would be a metaphor for my family history of locks and keys and so on and so forth. So putting all this together, ultimately what it boiled down to is that there's a certain kind of poetry that I was interested in writing, that I enjoyed reading, that meant that I wouldn't be writing these poems in the approximation of Houdini's historical voice, Eric Weiss's real voice. And if I had chosen to write that, I would have written it as prose.
Okay. What makes you feel like that would have necessarily pushed it in the direction of prose?
Well, because it seems to me that the fundamental purpose of doing that would be to emphasize a mimetic relationship with the character, right? I mean, you're trying to make it as realistic as you could, but it's going to vastly get in the way of relishing of language and poetic form in a way that prose doesn't have any concerns for. If you're concerned about writing it in the voice of Houdini and making it as realistic as you could for Eric Weiss, the actual historical man, you know, then the instant you add a line break and you create some kind of resonance there with enchantment, suddenly you're working against what you're intending to do, right? Because he wouldn't think like that, he wouldn't talk like that, and that wouldn't be his concern. So already you're sort of undermining this historical figure. So rather than it being a kind of gesture of respect, again, it's something that you're working against, you're playing underneath, you know? So none of it seemed fundamentally right for the project that I was conceiving. Even though there's no question that this obviously isn't Houdini's voice, the way I thought about it and think about it still is that if Houdini were to speak in poetry, I think that this would be something like what he would speak like.
strangle, falling like an angel with your broken wings behind the sun. She comes on like lightning, and she leaves like rolling thunder. She offers her love, but all you know how to receive is hunger.
All right, that was Gil Laundrie, and from his album The Ballad of Lala Soiree, that was Gasoline Legs. So, you've been listening to Vezineric Rhyme, and this is our final episode, and you heard my interview with Stephen Price, whose book Anatomy of Keys is available from Brick Books. And I'm just going to let you know about one other poetry event that's coming up, and that's Thursday, May 3rd, so next week, at Robson, UBC Robson downtown. And that's at 7 p.m., and it's a reading by Catherine Greenwood and Steve Noyes. They are both sort of Vancouver Island poets. Catherine Greenwood's most recent book is Pearl King and Other Poems. I think that's actually her first book. And Steve Noyes, his most recent is Ghost Country. And I think he's got a few more under his belt, maybe like three or four. So if you want to go down to that, that would be, I'm sure, rewarding. And yeah, stay tuned for Reel to Reel, which is the next show coming up on CITR 101.9. And thanks to everybody who's listened to this show. And thanks to everyone who said nice things about it and been encouraging. And I hope you all heard some poets that you hadn't necessarily heard of. And yeah, keep enjoying CITR.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Reel to Reel at the Movies. Robert Waldman back on CITR FM 101.9. Now, we have lots of new movies to talk about today, plus a few holdovers from the past couple of weeks. Let I remind you that on May the 4th, I believe Spider-Man 3 hits theaters. And I understand it's going to be mobbed with people, especially young kids who want to see Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst and James Franco and all the gang from the first two Spider-Mans do battle against three master criminals. More about that later. Why don't we first begin with a court case, a thriller starring Sir Anthony Hopkins, the movie Fracture. Lawyers are often the brunt of bad jokes and plain jealousy. New life is breathed into the legal system as a storyline in Fracture, the latest thriller from Alliance Atlantis and Odeon Films, now showing all over British Columbia. Moses is credited with receiving the Ten Commandments from God. Among those ancient principled rules was thou shalt not commit adultery. Generations since those tablets came down, countless men and women have strayed from their marital vows. News of a husband murdering his wife leads to a monumental struggle in this thriller. Fracture sees California aerospace pioneer Ted Crawford charged with capital murder. Dead beauty Jennifer Crawford, his wife, confounds all concerned as all fingers point to her husband. Cagey as a rat, our defender goes up against L.A. prosecutor Willie Beckham, who seems a bit wet behind the ears with more pressing things on his mind. Dollar signs weigh heavily on Willie's thinking, who assumes convicting Crawford of the murder would be a mere formality and a feather in his cap. Instead, we have a non-lawyer managing to somehow outfox the seasoned legal whiz in a cunning tale of courtroom chicanery that all concerned should relish. Ontario-born Ryan Gosling, so good in The Notebook is full of value as a mixed-up Willie. Up against this country boy hick is Academy Award-winning actor Sir Anthony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs, who pulls off another heroic performance as a layman whose superior intellect runs roughshod over his legal opponent. Enjoy the cat-and-mouse musings between these two, whose joust courtside are just a prelude to all the intrigue behind the scenes in this effort to make the guilty accountable. Hearts War director Gregory Hoblit succeeds in pulling off a tense court case that works due to the surprises that spring up. Solid supporting work from legal colleagues David Strathairn from Good Night and Good Luck and Rosamund Pike from Die Another Day, along with Ambev Davids from Schindler's List, make this court case thriller the ideal topic for water cooler chatter. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm giving Fracture an 8.